Welcome to episode 9 of Old Fox, Young Fox, with your hosts, Oliver Happy and Jeremy Woolwich. This episode is brought to you by Independent Perspective, a strategic and creative UK-based consultancy. For a fresh perspective on your business, head over to independentperspective.co. So Jeremy, what are we going to talk about today again?
Well, we're going to talk about the subject of agile, which is something that's fairly new to me. But it comes out of conversations we've previously had, where we've talked about the complexity of the world and how things are speeding up and decisions are becoming much, much more complex, and how increasingly we're going to need other ways of looking at how we deal with these levels of complexity. And I just happened to meet Dan Millwood.
Milbank.
At least he did better with your name than he did with Jeff Bezos. No,
So I met recently with Dan Millbank, and Dan introduced me to the concept of agile. And we had this conversation. It became quite clear to me that really there are many other organizations who could be benefiting from some of the principles that underlie agile, and that we perhaps need to have a conversation about it and introduce people to it. So as a consequence of that, I asked Dan to take part in a podcast with us. So perhaps, Dan, you'd like to just give us a little bit of background.
Sure. So thanks, Jeremy. Thanks, Ollie, for inviting me. I basically work as a what's called an agile team coach. So what that means is I go into typically software development teams, and I try to give them ways of working that adhere to the kind of the agile principles and values. So a bit about my background, bounced around different jobs. And then about 10 years ago, I managed to get a role in IT, very junior, through a friend. And that was initially in the kind of quality assurance software testing space. And then through a bit of luck, good fortune, I was introduced to Scrum, which is kind of, if people know anything about Agile, it's a safe bet that Scrum is the framework that they're kind of familiar with or have heard of. So I was at a global bank doing Scrum, and I'll talk about doing and being later. I didn't really understand what I was doing it. I had just learnt it and I was repeating it. And then as my career progressed, I actually got to understand the values that underpin Agile. And then once I understood those values, it kind of became, maybe a cause is the wrong word, but it started to resonate with me. And then I started to see the opportunities around helping people around their work life. And also I woke up with a career that I, by rights, wouldn't have had.
So why should we be interested in the concept of agile?
I mean, for me, it talks about, it's looking at how we're working currently and what optimizations can we make? How can we make this better? Not just for our stakeholders or the people who we're servicing, but also for ourselves, because we're the ones actually doing the work. We're the ones operating in these environments. Just, is there a better way to do it?
Because the only thing I did know about Agile was that really it evolved and was used in manufacturing, and in particular in the areas of IT development and so on and so forth. But it's sort of coming out of that sort of niche, and it's having a broader sort of application. Would that be right?
The Agile was popularized by software development, and traditional software development is something called Waterfall. So Waterfall was a very long sequential process where essentially the next stage didn't start until the previous stage had completely finished. It's very long, very expensive, very prone to error. But for some reason, it seemed to be the way to build software systems.
And I think maybe that had come out of construction and big construction projects like bridges.
Should make a little shout out for Ollie at this stage, because this is also his area of expertise, one of the few. But so I'm looking forward to hearing him in full flow throughout this conversation.
Thank you, mate. I feel the warmth from here. Right. So agile, effectively, if you had to sum it up to your mum,
yeah,
what would you say?
I don't know. I don't tend to talk about my mum doesn't know what I do for a living anyway. She would just say computers.
It does. I mean, as an outsider, knowing far less about this than either of you two, it does sound rather niche.
Like a buzzword, right?
Yeah. And there are a lot of buzzwords associated with it, like Scrum Master and Servant Leader. Is it
Servant Leadership?
Servant Leadership. Great concepts. And perhaps we can expand on them. But can we just demystify it a little bit? The purpose of it is to make things happen quicker and more efficiently, more effectively.
Yeah. So it's interesting Ollie mentioned the construction thing, right? Because there's something called the Cynefin model. Okay, and I won't go into it in full detail, but the Cynefin model is basically a way of describing problems, different types of problems. And in the at the top of the Cynefin model, you have on the left-hand side, you have complex problems, and on the right-hand side, you have complicated problems. And the first time I was exposed to that, I didn't get it. I was thinking,
they both sound hard.
They're the same thing. And then it got explained to me, the penny dropped. So in the case of, say, maybe a road or a rail and infrastructure project, that is something that's quite complicated. Done it a whole bunch of times before. There's an element of uncertainty, but the uncertainty isn't the overriding aspect of the problem. Whereas when you're talking about systems and software systems, they tend to be complex in that the solution doesn't immediately present itself at the start. And because that solution isn't there, you can't actually plan for it.
And here's an example. So if someone said to you, I want you to build Amazon. I want a website that I can buy and sell things, and particularly want to apply that to books, but then I'd like to apply it to food and other things, and I want those things to be delivered to people's homes. That actually sounds relatively simple in terms of delivering that to a board of directors and saying, this is what we want to go and do. Give us some funding, right? But the technology underneath that to make that happen, it's not just a website. It's actually a series of databases and a whole lot of code that together has to know the number of the item, know the price. It has to be able to take your credit card details. It has to be able to put those somewhere that's safe. If you're in France, it can't put them in the same place as if you're in America because of privacy. And then the delivery system has to be a system that alerts the driver when to pick things up and when to drop them off. There's a lot to that. It's not simple. And that's why Agile has been helpful, because Agile, effectively, as I understand it, and you'll be able to comment on this, Dan, is a way of thinking about solving problems, particularly breaking them down in small parts and then working quickly to come to solutions, but also listening to things that change and adapting to those changes.
And what scale of problem or what scale of enterprise do you need to be to really benefit from the use of something like Agile?
Any. The kind of the use case for it is most successful when it's in these smaller scale environments. That's often why you see the successes around tech startups, because they start off very small. It's this idea of iterative development. So essentially, what you're going to do is you're going to try something, you're going to collect some data, and then you're going to maybe try it a little bit differently. And that's there's some overlap around the lean and agile,
and also design thinking.
Absolutely, yeah. So design thinking is often a precursor to starting off your agile development. So the design thinking will help you frame the problem and get you to that point of where, okay, well, this is what we're going to try. And then once you get that, then you try it for 2 weeks. Collect some more data, decide what we're going to do in the next 2 weeks. And it's very simple at its core. And I think that's where it comes out. If you take a simple approach to doing difficult things, that's where it can be hard for people to kind of grasp. Like you said about the Amazon thing, it seems incredibly complicated, but just chunk it down and take these small steps. And then the other side of it is that as you're implementing these practices, also have that look inwards to see how we're working. Can we work in a better way? And that's that's often harder in big organizations because you've got a lot of infrastructure, you've got a lot of hierarchies to deal with. Whereas if it's just five guys in a garage, they're going to do what they want, right? Within reason, but they are actually going to do what they want. They are the masters of their own.
They'll be flexible. Destiny. They'll move quickly. They'll talk to each other, really communicate well. They'll revisit. They'll work in 2 week sprints. Yeah, that's true. Let's just define a couple of these things. So if agile is a way of thinking about solving problems, and if it's broken down into sprints, and it's broken down into maybe 2 weeks or 4 weeks.
What are we talking about when talking about sprints? What's a sprint?
So a sprint is just the word for a time box. Okay, so you will basically say a time box of 2 weeks, or a time box of 3 weeks, or a time box of 1 week, and it's just the name you're associating to that period of time. You could call it something else. The word sprint came from getting people around this idea of not these big epic long marathon type
4 years journeys. To build a bridge.
Absolutely. Let's do something quickly, take a little bit of time to recover, and we'll sprint again. And actually that pace is actually more sustainable than that marathon.
And are there some other terms that we need to know?
Yeah, so perhaps there's a couple of other ones you touched on, which people might be thinking about. So perhaps lean as opposed to agile.
So lean is the, as you mentioned, Ollie, is more of the end-to-end flow, looking at the business from the proposition to the outcome. Agile kind of sits in the middle of that and is just how that work is going around and iterating.
Beautiful. So, and then another one was Scrum.
Scrum. So Scrum is a framework. So Agile is the overall practices, values, and beliefs. And then this idea of agility, there's different ways you can achieve agility, and that's applying different frameworks, of which Scrum is a framework. There's another framework called Kanban. And then when you're talking about enterprise organizations, the holy grail is being able to get this small scale system, small one or two teams, to then say huge systems where you're talking 10, 20, 30, 100 teams. Because once you start scaling it, that's when those efficiencies, that autonomy that you had as a small team then starts to break down a bit.
Cool. And Scrum? Just in a couple of sentences.
So Scrum is a framework that basically gives people some ceremonies to follow. And by ceremonies, I mean meetings. It gives a regular cadence around the sprint.
Words like ceremonies, is that part of the... Is that just an adjective you're using? Was that part of the whole...
No, because I say it's because it's used...
A lot of it's Japanese, isn't it?
Yeah, and meetings will have a negative context, right? And it's around getting people, it's around engagement. When you think of a meeting, you tend to think of a whole room of people where only maybe one or two people talk, and there's an agenda and there's a structure. A ceremony is a bit, when it's a ceremony, kind of everyone's engaged, everyone is there for the same reason, right? And it's about being an active part of your work, not passive.
And the Scrum is actually coming out of the rugby, isn't it? I mean,
the idea of getting together as a group.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And to push something over the line.
Yeah. We that sense of autonomy, we know the best way to deliver stuff, as opposed to, say, a manager or a director looking outwards. Okay, so we know the work we have to do. We are the ones best placed to decide how that work happens.
So it's very much, I mean, just looking at it from the outside, it's a very much a cultural thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is, and it's they've got agile ways of working, as opposed to getting away from the names of different frameworks, which are often sold and have certifications around them. It's about agile ways of working. When you talk about agile ways of working, it then becomes much more applicable outside of the software development sphere.
So give me some characteristics of this culture, the ideal culture for an agile business.
So ideally, you're talking about autonomous, emergent, self-organizing teams. Okay,
so teams would be what sort of size?
So the kind of rough rule of thumb is 5 ± 2. So you're talking for a small team, 3 people. That can be a bit tricky, but yeah, up to 7. When you get up to about 9, you can maybe push it to 9 if you're in a high-performing team, but you wouldn't want to go any higher than that, because then these ceremonies that we're talking about, you're now actually engaging a lot more people, and there's a lot more chance that people can become disengaged and not active members of that team community.
And the teams are hierarchical or very flat? I mean, how?
Completely flat. So my role, say, as a scrum master or as an agile team coach, that's where this idea of servant leadership comes in, because essentially you have no power, no authority in the team whatsoever. The team is all autonomous. What you may know is the ways to do things better, but even in that case, you don't want to tell a team how to do things better, because there's no value in that. What you want to be able to do is initiate those conversations, and ideally you want the team to come up with the idea themselves.
Who makes the decisions?
Let's maybe talk about the roles, the key
roles.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, thank you, Ollie. Okay. So in a scrum team, there's only 3 roles. The scrum master or the team coach, the product owner, and then everyone else is a team member. The main role of the product owner is this is the person who defines the priorities of the team, and they provide the voice of the customer.
So that's what I do, and that basically means that I spend half of my time talking to the team and half of my time listening to others, customers, management teams, other teams, partners.
So one of the biggest problems with the old waterfall methodology is that often, say after 2 years, you'd completed your software project and you handed it over to the customer. The most common thing you heard from a customer was, "That's not what I wanted." And the response of the delivery team would be, "But that is what you asked for." Okay. So you actually had, so when you started 2 years ago, you've actually spent 2 years diverging from what the customer actually wanted. That product owner allows that fast feedback, that constant voice of the customer, to ensure what the team's building is the right thing.
I have a strong sense of deja vu here, bearing in mind we're in the middle of Brexit. You know, this is, I mean, I'd love to introduce that thought a little bit later and see how, if in a complex situation like Brexit, how if there'd been, or if there was some agile thinking employed there, how things might have been different.
Let's do that. Yeah, let's do that. So, okay, so coming back to the roles, there's 3 roles. You've talked about product owner and the voice of customer.
Yeah. So then you'll have the agile team coach, who is basically helping the team to follow good practices and practices that benefit them, identifying what's called anti-patterns. So these kind of behaviors that on the surface feel like they're offering a benefit, but actually when you look at them a little bit deeper, they might be holding the team back.
Have you got an example of that?
So when you're talking about, so software, you're talking about software, you have the development side, and then there's an element of testing or quality assurance. Okay. And then one of the things that the framework does is actually remove that distinction between a developer and a QA. Because what you would often have is that's where you would have a handover. You would have the developers maybe building a lot of stuff, and then you would have a bottleneck whilst the QAs tested it. And then actually what you would have is developers starting more work because they need more work. But all they're doing is creating more code that can't actually be used until it's tested. So that in that scenario, you're basically looking at everyone and everyone's thinking, everyone's working really hard. You've got developers just churning out line after line, line after code. And then you've got QA engineers or software testers desperately trying to keep up so that they can deliver the value out of the other end.
Chucking it over the fence.
Over the fence. And then actually by removing those distinctions and actually saying, look, we are all one team. There's no point Dave producing all this code that doesn't actually make it out the other end. Dave's feel like he's earned his money, but we haven't actually delivered any value. And it's highlighting that it's the team that succeeds or fails, not individuals, not functions. So it's being able to highlight that, because if you ask these individuals, everyone would say they were performing. And even if you looked at it from a kind of performance review process, everyone's working really hard. So you can't actually fault everyone, but actually, are we being effective? And it's the kind of the team coach's role to just have that little step back and say, look, is there a better way of doing this? Can anyone see a problem with how we're working? Asking those questions.
I think it might be useful also to just give, before we move on to apply Agile to other things and talk more broadly, just to talk about Scrum and the ceremonies at a very high level, what that 2 weeks might look like, because I think that's going to apply to a lot of other topics.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. So you've got a 2 week time box, and basically in that time box, so you have something called a backlog. And a backlog, very simply, is all the queue of the things that you need to do. Okay. And let's say there's 20 items in that backlog. The team will look at that backlog and say, well, in 2 weeks, we can do the first four things. The ones at the top, which the product owner has said are the priority, we will take these four and look to deliver them in our sprint. During that 2 weeks, there's something called the daily stand-up, which is just a very quick 15-minute meeting with the whole team where everyone updates each other, okay? And you asked about anti-patterns and ways of working. Often, those meetings can turn into status meetings where people will update the product owner or update the Scrum Master. That's not the point of it. The point of it is the team aligning around their sprint goal, their sprint objective to deliver these four items. So they're updating each other. That's the daily sprint.
And what's the key thing that they are talking about?
The items that they're working on that day.
And things that might block them.
Block them. Yeah, absolutely. So, thank you.
I usually do that to Jeremy.
You have your uses, Ollie.
And actually, thank you for that, because it's one of the key roles of the Scrum Master, actually, is to remove those impediments. Okay, so if someone is blocked on an item, the Scrum Master now takes that and is looking to remove that for the team, or help the team remove it for themselves so that they can continue working. At the end of the sprint, and these can be interchangeable, but at the end of the sprint, you'll have a showcase or a demo, which is basically the team showing to the product owner their completed work to ensure that we have delivered not necessarily what was asked for, but what was wanted. Okay. And then the final one, and in my opinion, the most important, is something called a retrospective. And that's when the team get together. They look at how they worked over the last 2 weeks, what went well, what not so well, what do they want to carry on doing, any behaviors they want to stop doing, and looking to identify actions that they're going to carry into the next sprint. So that they're constantly looking for this continuous improvement, which is one of the things from Lean, this concept of Kaizen and the Toyota way of finding these small incremental improvements. Yeah, so that's the ceremonies. You have a sprint planning, a daily stand-up, a showcase or a demo, and then a retrospective.
Very good. So amongst all this stuff, the culture thing is the bit that I'm interested in, because it's a very different way of working. Wearing the old fox, young fox hat, most old foxes are not brought up in that tradition. It's much more hierarchical, top down. It must be quite difficult in a large organization to affect that change if you're only one small part of that organization. Would that be the case?
Yeah, and so when we're talking about those scaled frameworks,
Did somebody just
scratching?
Did you just scratch your mic?
I was just scratching.
Okay.
That's allowed.
Well, is it allowed?
You're going to have forgotten the question again,
isn't it?
I think the question really is around, is the cultural one.
Not about hygiene.
Yeah, the cultural one. Around, I mean, this is a very different way of working, very different way of thinking, a very different way of organising people. And it just seems to me that you've got people who've been brought up in a very, very different tradition who are suddenly confronted with this new way of operating. It must be very difficult to effect that transition.
I mean, absolutely. And I'm stealing some of this from a chap called Simon Powers, who has a company called Adventures with Agile, who almost specialise in this enterprise agility space. And one of the things they talk about is often when organisations have made the decision to move to Agile, they'll employ some coaches, some Scrum Masters to help them with that evolution. And one of the main things they have to do is actually they're coaching the resistance to it, because there are these legacy hierarchies, and it is completely understandable because there's often people who have worked very long and very hard to attain these positions of authority, of decision-making, budgetary control. And actually, now you get these bunch of people coming in their jeans and their Converse and
T-shirt. Often quite young people.
Yeah, and saying, this isn't the way to do it anymore. Okay, so now what do you do? Okay, and so you are going to get that resistance. And in most cases, the old paradigm has worked and it has been effective. We're not talking about ailing companies or companies like on the verge of bankruptcy. We're talking about multinationals, blue chips that are successful. But as you mentioned, in this rapidly changing world where technology is leveraged so quickly and so pervasively, the old models, the old project management paradigm, if you want to compare that, isn't applicable. It's not appropriate so much. And that's not to say it hasn't got its place. But like we said, we were talking about, if you're looking to solve a complicated problem, project management. I mean, the Olympic site, perfect for project management. You wouldn't have done London 2012 in an agile way, you could argue. That was much more appropriate to use project management. But like I said, if you don't know what the end solution looks like, that's when you need to take a more iterative, experimental is maybe a good word.
Ollie, I know you've been involved both with very large organisations and also startups, you know, working with Agile. I mean, what was your experience of the differences between the two?
They're huge differences. And I think the interesting thing is that there's an understanding across both groups that this is something we need to do. We need to become more Agile. We need to move quicker. We need to get to market quicker. We need to adapt quicker. Otherwise, we'll fall behind. I think that understanding is universal, particularly in technology, but also in health services, education, government, large organizations. I think what's really different is that, like you were saying, Dan, large organizations have a lot more to change. They are slower. And that idea of a large number of people moving slowly towards a goal and even slower to turn their heads to a different goal, that predates Agile by hundreds of years, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what's been interesting for me is recently moving from a large organization to a much smaller one, how much more speed there is. I'll give you an example. I used to get a large number of emails. I think that's pretty common to any of our listeners or anybody in the modern world who's connected in any way to technology. So you could get 50 to 100 emails in a day, and then some of those might need doing, some of those might need saving or just reading and deleting. I now work in an organization where I get very few emails. Those emails really are just event notifications and updates from different applications, so they get filed. Most of my work now comes from Slack. In terms of conversations,
Yeah.
Hey, could we have a chat about this?
Do you just explain what Slack is for those that don't know?
Yeah, sure. So Slack, and we obviously talked about this on the Tech Tuesday, but Slack is effectively a text messaging for businesses over the computer and over your phone. So just like you might use WhatsApp to message your kids or message your friends, in Slack, there'll be rooms and groups of people called engineering and sales and our main customer and project one and project two involving people from different organizations. And there'll be chats happening in these rooms, mostly one-liners and very similar to WhatsApp in that sense. What's really interesting is that chatter on email, those long emails and the discussions that would go on and then the meetings that would be called and the slide decks that would be presented are replaced with very short conversations, one-liners. Hey, could you tell me the thing? Here's the thing. Thank you so much. Or let's have a chat about this. I'll talk to you tomorrow at stand-up. There's already a meeting coming and we can talk about it then. So it's quite a different way of working, and it means more face-to-face contact. So you could actually say, in some ways, there's more meetings, but they are very small meetings.
Yeah.
And they're just me talking to Dan about that thing that Dan needed, that I need, or the thing that he's going to unblock me on as the Scrum Master.
Because this seems to be the other aspect, which is that almost counterintuitively, there are more face-to-face meetings. Face-to-face meetings seem to be making a comeback, whereas at one point they were sort of, you know, being replaced by emails and sort of video conferencing and all that sort of stuff. But
yeah, and I wonder, Ollie, if this is your experience, but it almost seems, because I remember a time, obviously, before these online collaboration tools became like really, really prevalent. An email was almost you creating a written record of something. And it was a bit of ass covering to a certain extent. Okay, well, I'm going to put this in writing and now it's on an email server and it can't be disputed, right? And then if you look about where these like small emergent autonomous teams, they didn't have the need for that. They had such a high level of personal, professional and social trust that they didn't need it. Okay. And that's what I like to think is happening with the use of these online collaborations or these very quick little like micro meetings, is that actually I'm saying to Ollie, I trust you not to screw me over on this because we're having a conversation. You're saying X, I agree, and we're going to go do it. And there's no requirement to now document it and copy in seniors and subordinates. And I don't, do you feel that? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think I've sent an email with a CC, with a carbon copy, with a copying someone else so that the other person can see they're included in the last 6 months.
Wow. Yeah, that's, yeah.
And I haven't produced a slide deck in that time.
Yeah.
And I used to spend a large amount of my time putting reports together for large stakeholder teams. Mm. So that's a huge difference. And I think you've touched on something there, Dan, which is, there's an element of personal responsibility and trust. And there's also an element of transparency.
Yeah.
Because you and I both know tomorrow morning we're going to be talking about all the things that are going on. And if you haven't fixed my thing, I'm going to say, yeah, Dan was a bit busy yesterday, but there was this thing I needed help with. And so there is this element of transparency that builds that trust.
Yeah.
And in it together.
Yeah.
So the process builds the trust and the relationships. So you can go into any organization that hasn't had Agile in it before, who mm-hmm. works in a very traditional, perhaps slightly old-fashioned way. And on day one, you could start to build those sort of relationships and that level of trust simply by introducing this different way of working. Or are some organisations, or do you have to start with a blank sheet of paper, you know, where you're training people and educating people as to how they should be behaving in this new sort of Agile world?
Well, I think that's quite an interesting point because it is change. And change is going to be resisted, as you've mentioned, Dan, and you're right. And I've rolled Agile out a handful of times, and each time there were people who chose to move with the new direction, and there were people who chose not to move with the new direction. Is that what you've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. And you, especially in the software space, you get high-performing individuals. And often high-performing individuals, and this is a generalization, right? But some of these high-performing individuals will come with their own set of behaviors that aren't conducive.
I don't want you to feel like we're targeting you, Jeremy.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, some of this resonates. That's coincidence.
Yes.
But these high-performing individuals, okay, but they are accepted because...
If they're in IT, they might be on the spectrum.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But yeah, absolutely. But
100% they might be.
Yeah. Mm. I want to take that separately. I'm talking about people who have a very high level of, let's call it arrogance. I'm not talking about, people on the spectrum. I'm just talking about people who don't care about other people because they're so good, they're just going to do it their way, right? Now, when you have that, when you're talking about these autonomous teams, right, the personal responsibility, right, the team delivering, you actually want those people out of your team. They are a negative impact. It's a team of mediocre coders will deliver far more than a team of mediocre coders with even two rock stars in them, because those rock stars they cause the friction, not the conflict, because conflict is actually a good thing. You want, if you have a high level of trust in a team, you get a high level of conflict and a high level of challenge, because everyone's trying to get better. But friction is a different thing. And yeah, it's that accountability, the team is accountable to themselves.
And that, what you've just described in terms of a team of mediocre people delivering more with harmony and with open trust and communication and conflict and challenge than a team of a couple of rock stars and some mediocre people is exactly the opposite of the traditional sales team. Is that what you've seen, Jeremy? If you think back over the years, certainly what I've seen.
What people... did I tell you about him, Mark? You're suddenly giving me a question like that.
Everybody wants to be included, Jeremy. Equal opportunity.
The reality is, in most sales teams that I'm familiar with, the rock stars are given their head. They're allowed to do what the hell they want and ride roughshod over because they're delivering the sales, and that's the priority. But I do think that's old thinking. It's difficult to define it.
We could talk amongst ourselves, can't we?
Yeah, of course we can. I mean, so Jeremy's question about organisations and culture was a very expansive one, which is why I think we kept kind of diverging off it. But it is really important because, like, they're the ones that have to deal with the most amount of change, and then their drivers for it is this drive to be competitive. Because you asked the question about the organisations and making change in those organisations, and to paraphrase it, how easy it is to make that change. The short answer is it's actually very, very hard. There's a chap called Craig Larman, who's been involved in thousands of organisational agile implementations is the wrong word.
Transformations.
Yeah, all awful words, but helping companies reach a level of agility. And he has these, the Larman's laws, the five laws of organizational change. And he writes them in a very kind of eloquent way. I wish I could know them off the top of my head. But he basically says that these organizations are inherently designed to maintain the status quo. And actually, if you want to change a company's culture, you first have to change that structure, okay? Because if you are deploying, in inverted commas, agile, and you haven't changed the structure, all you're doing is layering it over the top of your existing work practices. And we all worked in companies where people are, luckily, if they're only 95% at capacity. So where's the space for them to adopt these new ways of working? So in a typical agile transformation, everyone's working in their same patterns with their same power structures. You then get a bunch of coaches come in and then they start talking about the things we were talking about, the Scrum, Kanban, ceremonies, and we're going to do all of these things. Whilst all the other structures are in place, whether it's project managers or financial controllers,
management teams,
business analysts, whatever. So now actually that's why I say you've just dumped it over the top, because you actually haven't created the space and the roles to accept this change. And that is why it's so difficult, and it's on a personal level and an organizational level. And it's this driver around this need to say, let's say the need to be competitive, or the need to maintain a position in a market, was actually the agility thing is, like I said, it's much, much more people centric. Okay. It's actually recognized this is hard work, but we don't want the work to be hard, if that makes sense. Okay. We want to make it an environment where we can succeed and we can do this hard work in a sustainable way that we can carry on enjoying.
Do young foxes adapt to this more easily, or is it equally?
No, the team I'm currently working in is actually a little bit of a dream for a coach, because I've got a great mix, a diverse people, backgrounds, experience, age. If anything, I would say the young foxes are almost struggling with it a little bit more, because a lot of these software developers, if I said to a software developer in my team has got 20 years worth of software development experience, it's safe. Agile's been around 20 years. They might not have been in agile environments their entire career, but they are definitely aware of a concept. This might be a bold statement. I don't think you would find a software developer that likes the old waterfall methodology. They're always really responsive. They want to do things in this agile way because they recognize it's the best or the easiest way to do things.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Then these young foxes who don't actually have so much experience, and actually I'd say it's a weakness. Some of these computer science grads have got such a surface level of understanding of agile. They've maybe sat in front of a 2-hour PowerPoint presentation on agility and iterative development. But those values and those beliefs, they'd say, we haven't mentioned it, there's something called the Agile Manifesto, where what we say is we value working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation. Okay, we're saying there's value in things on the right, but it's the things on the left we value far more.
And they may just not have really experienced that yet.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it's that thing of get them young, get them in the good habits. Absolutely.
So when you talk about large organizations that just don't change, that immediately brings me back to one of the topics of the previous episodes and something that's affecting Britain a lot right now, which is Brexit. So if we were to apply the current conundrum of our parliamentary structure and look at that with what you would do as an agile coach if you had the chance and the mandate.
And the mandate, yeah. So, I mean, I've thought about this a couple of times. I'd like to hear what some smarter people in the agile space than me have to say about it, because it seems like this is absolutely a complex problem. This is absolutely something where we should be taking regular checkpoints of our data. First of all, deciding what we need to measure, what are our kind of success metrics, and then see how we're progressing against those. And then if it's wrong, it's wrong. There seems to be this need for Brexit to be the person who was right from the start. Okay. And I think you can talk about people who voted Remain or people that voted for Leave. When we talk about people voting to Leave, maybe changing their mind, that is based on having more information now. And that makes perfect sense. I'm sure there's actually Remainers who are now seeing what's going on. They now have more data and they are now probably Leavers.
I think this is where we move into the area of design thinking, because design thinking really is about understanding the process. And it's an iterative process that seeks to understand what the user's really thinking and then challenging assumptions and trying to redefine the problems based on the new information that you get in an attempt to identify alternative strategies and solutions. And I think that's what we've been missing in the Brexit thing. And then you've got the whole agile area where you start taking the outcomes of those and then working them through in ways that lead you to a sort of manageable conclusion.
It's really interesting. So there is a YouTube clip of Angela Merkel addressing the Bundestag, and she's talking about agility. She's actually saying that is something they need to look at from their government, placing the customer or the people they should be serving at the heart of it, taking smaller iterative steps and constantly reviewing, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing, instead of having this bullish attitude that if I say it, it's correct and we're going to see it through to the end regardless.
It's this idea that says you don't actually know where the end is, and therefore you need a process to help you get wherever that end is in a sensible way that works for everybody.
Yeah, and they often say, don't they, that in the Agile Manifesto, I believe, that Agile is a journey, not a destination.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. A smaller scale problem would be HS2, right? That started as one thing.
Do you want to just define that for folks?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so HS2 is the high-speed rail link, I believe, and if phase one is between London and Birmingham, and then phase two is Birmingham to the north.
Beyond the wall, yeah. Jeremy.
Where the dragons...
and we're looking at that, right? And the costs have skyrocketed, right? We maybe, who knows, maybe there was a bit of false accounting at the start just to get
blasphemy
through Parliament. But that's absolutely the case to think, do you know what? This sounded like a good idea. There's a concept of don't fall in love with your ideas, right? And at the time, it was a good idea. Now we've got more information. If we were to make that decision again, we wouldn't make it. So then why would you continue on that track? But I think I don't know if there's a particular thing in politics about admitting your mistakes as being a weakness, right? Because it doesn't happen. I can't think of a scenario where someone actually held their hands up and said, yeah, do you know what? I fucked that totally. But at the time... In the agile coaching space, there's this concept of unconditional positive regard. Okay, so when I'm talking to my team or an individual, on a fundamental level, I believe this person is a good person and is doing their best. No one comes to work intentionally wanting to do a bad job. Okay, and if you hold that feeling, that belief, it actually becomes quite easy to trust people. And I can't remember the name of this, but there's another concept around treating people how you want them to be, not how you are. If you treat someone how they are,
aspirational,
they will invariably
something
be less. Yeah, absolutely. But if you treat them how you want them to be, they will invariably raise to that expectation.
Very interesting. Love those concepts.
But yeah, how would you do that? How would you look at a politician with unconditional positive regard?
But again, in fairness, I think that is a criticism levelled at them, and it's a very popular thing to say. But I suspect that the vast majority of politicians go in there with the best intentions and are doing their best. It's just the system grinds them down. It's the system. And if some of these principles were applied in that situation, it changed them dramatically, I suspect.
Yeah, there's a story of a guy called Peter Garrett, who is the lead singer, or was the lead singer of Midnight Oil, a rock and roll band out of Australia in sort of the 80s and 90s. And he was a huge activist, used his notoriety to get into politics, was a green politician with great fanfare, finally elected in a country that's not particularly green when it comes to, say, if you compare it to Scandinavia or Europe. But getting that. And he went in with a couple of clear things that he was going to get done. He wanted to get rid of plastic bags. He wanted to get rid of the old style light bulbs, the halogens, and replace them with LEDs. And in order to do those two things, it took sort of 3 years of his life. He was ridiculed. He was torn down in the press. He was shouted at in Parliament. He got those two things done, but it was really, really difficult for him. So I think there might be some truth to the fact that people go into that environment with something in mind, and it could be quite noble, but actually find it quite a toxic and difficult organizational structure.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're talking about Parliament, right? When you're talking about Parliament, you are talking about the ultimate legacy structure, relatively unchanged in, what, 500 years? So, yeah, how do you manage that change? How do you coach that level of resistance? And again, people who have worked very hard, had long careers to get where they are. And actually, it must be incredibly difficult to think you could go in 4 years' time. And it's actually not even based on your personal performance. It's based on your parties or your affiliations.
Or the way the media has swung at that moment, yeah. Right?
And but also it's about personality type as well, and how certain personality types are attracted to certain professions. And again, I imagine that within the sort of whole agile space within businesses, there'll be certain personality types that are much more adaptive and much more open to making these sort of changes. Would that be a fair observation in a workspace? Or do you think everybody in an agile environment, where if they're surrounded by these great practices, will adapt and thrive in that environment? Yeah.
I think so.
Or do you have to kick some of them out?
I don't think you have to kick some of them out. I think they will just naturally waste away because it is not an environment they enjoy. And it's not one that's kind of suited to them. And that you're not intentionally managing them out. The ideal solution is to, or the ideal practice is to show them, like, so what is the pain you're experiencing? And can these different ways of working alleviate that pain? Some people are in love with their pain. Some people can't envisage a time without difficulty. But on the whole, my experience has been you show people a different way and it enriches their life. Like we spend an inordinate amount of our time at work. Most of us do. Most of us work for someone. Most of us are an employee. But if we had the choice, we'd choose to spend the time with our families, right? But we need to work. And this is what attracted me to that agile space, is that actually I had an opportunity, however small, to make that time slightly better. Because I've had jobs where I've woken up in the morning and I've had that kind of that sense of dread and that feeling that you're just heavy.
You share that sense of dread with about 78% of the UK working population, apparently.
Is it that
high? 78% of people in this country hate going to work.
That's scary, isn't it?
And there's another statistic, something like 30%, over 30% feel that if they weren't at work, the business wouldn't notice. Mm. The contribution they make is so insignificant that if they weren't there, nobody would notice.
And that's the difference between that being a drone and being autonomous. I like to think the teams I've worked with, the people I've worked with, didn't feel that kind of that sense that they were a drone. Because if they want to do something differently, if they say, look, can we try this? Yeah, absolutely, we can try it. There's very little reason why you can't, in this agile space, to try something. So if a team comes to me and says, can we try something? I can't envision a time. So, okay, let's try it.
What are you thinking? Why do you want to do it?
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
And as a matter of fact, the two of you, I mean, are you aware of very large organisations that are actually doing this from top down? Or are they still very, very rare?
I think it depends on the industry, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there's so you will get...
All right, not software and IT.
Well, look, banking is a good example, right? You can talk about... let's talk about NatWest, okay? So NatWest, RBS. So still a very legacy-centric organization. But in parts of their business... they have fully embraced Agile. And actually, the NatWest mobile app is one of the best out there in terms of functionality and security. It's superb. But because they're so large, let's say, and this is an example, let's say their mortgage business might be still an incredibly manual process. It takes weeks to get all this data, which is just in a computer, it's data somewhere, but actually to collate it and aggregate it and analyze it is still a manual process.
And so I can attest to this because, sorry to interrupt, but I've recently gone through the process of remortgage, and the broker said, and often what people say, it reminds is kind of an insight into the way things were, not necessarily the way they are. And she actually said, you know, look, it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks to process this. A couple of forms, and it's going to take 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah. You can't understand how it takes 4 to 6 weeks, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And so, yeah, so you get, and even for an organization as large as RBS, that is a relative success. To have any success, right? And again, we should congratulate them, right? What you want to try and do is help that, those behaviors and those values then propagate through the organization.
And you know, what's something that I've noticed, and be interesting to hear if you've had the same experience, Dan, is particularly in my current workplace, particularly in startups, it is really a joy to go to work. And a lot of my old feelings and ideas from years gone by are challenged. So we get to the end of the weekend and my girlfriend will say, oh, it's Monday, I've got to go into work tomorrow. And I'll actually check in with myself and think, actually, I'm quite looking forward to going in tomorrow. I really like the people I work with. It's really good fun, lots of humor, bit of swearing, great work gets done. I enjoy what I do, and there's some things I want to get done for me and for the team. Have you experienced that when you talk to people in other industries?
I mean, Ollie, absolutely. I mean, even just recently, say, I was a full-time employee, and then I transitioned to contracting. And even just recently, I was at an organization, household name. I was actually pretty stoked that I'd kind of landed this gig, landed in the office. And then it's strange, like the first kind of 2 hours, I just felt like I wasn't part of anything. And that can be common for a contractor, right? Because you're not taken through the whole onboarding process and inducted and meet your team and they take you out.
You're just here to do the thing.
Yeah, yeah. And okay, I get that. But it was more than that. I almost felt like I was separate from everything. But I was like, okay, hey, look, come on, maybe it's just like first week blues and stuff. And it was a bit of a long commute. And I was like, I'm going to do my job here. I'm going to do what I know how to do. And it turns out this big organization thought they wanted me to do the thing I know how to do until it actually came to do it. And they're like, no, we can't have all those meetings. No, it's too much. Okay, so who's my team? Well, you got that guy 20% of the time. Sarah, she's great. Project manager, she'll be there 50% of the time. Those guys, you'll maybe get like 2 weeks every month. And I was like, what is this? Like, how? Ignore the fact that it was really hard for me to operate like that. How do these guys do it? And the analogy I tried to use with these directed is like, it's like a 4x400 meter relay race. And the baton is essentially the business value. This is the thing you want to deliver, okay? So everyone runs their race, everyone runs their leg, and the baton gets handed over and you try and do it in the quickest time possible, okay? If we talk about these legacy organizations, right? If you're a director and you're watching this relay race, and you're looking at it and you think, that person running leg three, they're just standing there. Why didn't they go and run the first leg of another race? And everyone's like, oh, that's genius. That's brilliant. Yeah, let's get extra utilization out of these runners. Yeah, and maybe after the person who's run the first leg, they can run the last leg of another race. Oh, mate, how do you come up with this stuff? This is brilliant. We're getting so much output of these people. Okay, so what do you think happens to that baton, right? Best case scenario is the person who was running leg three, who had to do the first leg of another race, makes it back to their original, but they're now knackered and they run a really slow time, or they don't even get there at all. So actually one race that should have taken you 2 minutes is now taking you hours. And actually, all your people are knackered because they're just doing too much for no reason. But then the senior managers or the leadership look down and just see a bunch of, like, using that drone analogy, everyone's busy, everyone's fully utilized, so we must be doing it correctly. And then I just struggled, and actually it was I kind of hit the limit of my expertise, because my skill set, I really like the team stuff. The enterprise stuff and the leadership coaching, it kind of does interest me, but I don't know enough about it. And that's what they needed. They needed people to tell the leader, you don't drop it in and tell everybody to do it. You need to understand the mindset. And there's a big drive actually that says people in these C-suite positions should have a better understanding of servant leadership, not this top-down directive style. But actually, are you creating an environment where people can come to you and say, hey, I don't know if you know, but we've got this good idea. I mean, I am not a technical person. I love the fact that these teams, all I do is start these conversations. I don't actually know the answers, but what I can do is maybe pull the strings or start the conversation that get the answers.
So I've got two examples that currently really talk to that. My current founder and CEO is involved in the sprints and takes tasks.
Oh, wow.
And she completes them. And something she said to me the other day was, I just feel so happy to have so many pairs of good hands to look after these bits of work. And what a different mindset to that you've just described.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard because until these people have experienced, I mean, the particular chap I'm talking about, he had a very kind of distinguished career, right? So he'd spent a good chunk of his time from university in in one of those blue chip service companies like Cap, Cog, Accenture, one of those. He then moved to this massive multinational, and the expectation was, can you do some slide decks? I don't know how to do a slide deck. What? That's crazy. I said, I don't. And it's a strange part of my role. I don't actually have an output, an outcome. Like, if you asked me what I do, what do I produce? Very little.
Is a really important key, because on what planet would that top-down approach say, Dan over there, who doesn't actually seem to be producing anything, is really important to my business?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I get to play games. I get to play Lego, right? We're talking about those insights. I can tell you how Scrum works, and I can tell you how Kanban works, and I can do that with a slide deck.
Kanban is effectively moving things from the left of the board to the right of the board, from to do, doing, to done.
Yeah? Absolutely. Or I can bring in a bunch of Lego and we can run an activity and we can build Lego using a Scrum framework or using a Kanban framework. And actually you get to understand it more, and then you decide which one of these frameworks feels best for the type of work we do. And it's the difference between knowledge gained and knowledge, or anything earned or anything given. The thing you earn always has more value to you than something that is just given to you.
And this is an important point too, because has it been your experience, as it has with mine, that the transparency and autonomy and trust that teams have within each other and within their business feels like something that they've earned?
Yes.
And they need to maintain and grow and deliver on.
Is this a model that could be used in schools?
So there's some really great, so guess where it's used in a school? Guess who are kind of pioneering this?
Primary schools.
The Netherlands, yeah.
Okay.
And secondary schools, but yeah.
Dan's doing it to you now, Jeremy.
Sorry?
Dan's doing it now, putting you on the spot. Sometimes, folks, we wonder if he's sleeping with his eyes open.
Yeah. Well, he just slumped down a little bit as well. I was like, is he even...
Well, I was just thinking, you know, this is... this is a modern way of operating. Mm. I mean, we've been banging on about...
Of course it is.
Traditionally, most of our conversations are about, you know, everything is changing, but the structures that we're operating within aren't keeping up. And suddenly you've introduced this idea of a... You think you call it agile, whatever, but it's a set of principles that are human-based, that are multidisciplinary, holistic. It's just common sense, it seems to me. And the sooner people can be introduced to it as early as possible, the better, one would have thought.
Absolutely. Let's and shall we go into that example of the Netherlands?
Yeah, I mean, so the whole education thing, I can feel a bit passionate about. Some of that is kind of my own hang-ups, my own baggage. I didn't have a great time at school. I didn't go to university, and like then I spent years bouncing around careers. I'm not blaming the education system, but there's not many social practices that you can look at that haven't changed for 150 years, okay? A teacher at the front, 30 kids behind, and then you're just launching information, okay? My daughter's five. She goes, the teachers are superb. Considering the constraints they have to operate in around the kind of the national curriculum and how they teach, they are looking for engagement, okay? And they genuinely do, again, the best job they can. When you talk about the Netherlands, okay, what they're saying is they're taking that autonomy, that emergency, the idea of actually you know what is best, okay? So we go back to the Scrum model, and I think there is something called Edu Scrum, if people want to look it up. But if you take this idea of a backlog or a queue of things that you need to do, okay, actually all the teacher needs to do is put all these things on a board, put them on post-its, and actually the class decide how and when they want to learn these subjects, okay? Let's say you've got an exam coming up in 3 months' time, okay? Okay, well now the class are going to look at that backlog and say, right, well, we know we've got a test in 3 weeks, so we're going to put these items on and that's what we would like the teacher to deliver to us, okay? Now they're engaged, okay? And all right, there's going to be things that you have those conversations. It helps they have smaller classes, okay? They have a different model to us. They don't start formal education until much later. There's a whole bunch of things they do better than us, especially when you talk about a drop-off in engagement. I don't know about you guys, but for me it felt like secondary school. When I hit secondary school, that's when I really started to feel like, okay, now I'm in a machine. And actually the machine is so big, if I just pull back a little bit, I start to become anonymous, and there's no real reason for me to get that engagement.
I was actually homeschooled until I was 12, and it really was apparent to me. It seemed almost a little bit military.
Yeah.
The bell goes, we all walk out. I'm not finished.
Yeah.
But you have to leave. It's time to leave the class.
Yeah.
What if we haven't finished?
Yeah.
The objective.
Yeah. It feels like you're training for your role in life, doesn't it?
Well, businesses, again, just a continuation of that traditionally. The way businesses are structured would just be a continuation of that sort of person, you know, the hierarchical, very clear roles and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you look at the way back in the day everyone used Mr. and Mrs., right?
Yeah.
There weren't even first names.
Yeah. I mean, Sweden, Sweden has an incredible startup mentality, okay? And that comes from their education system. So they have a very progressive primary school. I think it's, I'm not sure, maybe it's 7 or 8 until they actually start formal education. Everything is play up until then. Then, okay, there's a more recognisable structure
It's structured play. It's not just play.
Absolutely. Play. Yeah, yeah. And then university, and they finish university. Now, if you look at what most... say UK graduates will look at, they're looking to score a place on a grad program, right? Ideally a JP Morgan or an Accenture, or that's kind of the holy grail. Is that actually I've got all these debts. I just want to get a job. I just want to extract some value for the 4 years I've spent at
university. And I'll move to London and I'll do some hard graft.
Yeah. And I'll maybe get my life back when I'm 30. Maybe, right? Absolutely. In Sweden, you finish university, and it's more so if you've done so, but it still works for like marketing or sales. Let's get some mates and let's start something. Let's give it a go. Because worst case scenario, you spend 3 years, you go get a job. Okay, it turns out I wasn't actually very good. But invariably, because they have these like these cycles of, they have that startup mentality, just try something, A-B testing, experimenting, then you get incredible companies like Spotify. And everyone desperately tries to emulate it, but it comes from that thing of like, you built it from the ground up. It's not a model, it's an organic culture. Like, using that C word again, but.
But I think that's, ultimately, we're not talking about machines getting work done. We're talking about people getting work done. So, of course, it's culture. Of course it is.
Very good. I think we need a way of wrapping it up.
Do we?
Do you want to carry on?
I'm just going to have a drink, please. Sorry.
Do you think we should let him have a drink? He has been working hard.
Very hard.
Yeah. If you'd like to wrap it up, Jeremy.
Are you bored?
Not at all. No. He
actually looks like he's perked up.
Have we covered off most of what we wanted to cover, or are there any other? Is there anything else that we think is? Have we covered off? I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask, but I'm not clear whether it would be terribly helpful. Just taking a scenario of a startup, what would you do to what would you put in place? Would you have to put anything in place to emulate the sort of agile model? Or does it just happen naturally?
No, I think it's a good question. I think you need to have an understanding, right? You don't necessarily need to have an understanding of agile almost, but what you want to have an understanding of those beliefs and the sort of behaviors that you want to instill right from the beginning. Like you said, Ollie, like trust, transparency, okay? You could just sit in a room and decide, right, in this team, no one throws anyone under the bus. It's that kind of mentality, okay? And then it's not removing the personal responsibility. It's actually enhancing it. It's actually saying I'm responsible to myself and every single person.
And everything that happens will be discussed.
Yes.
Yeah. Regularly. That's key as well.
But again, you formalize it. You formalize the values.
So what do you mean by formalize it?
You sit down and you agree them. And if necessary, you write them down.
Yeah. I mean, there's a great practice with new teams. You set up something called a working agreement, which is basically saying, look, these are the things we want to do. We want to be yes and people, not no but people. We don't throw people.
And does somebody initiate that? So you, let's say for the sake of argument, the scrum leader or the
team coach, or the
team coach says, right, one of the values that we're going to operate under or operate to is nobody throws anybody else under the bus. Nobody throws anybody under the bus. Or do you allow that? And then you sort of, you establish that and then you enroll people to that value.
Yeah, no.
Or you allow it to operate organically.
You allow it to operate organically. I don't really want, because that whole throwing people under the bus concept, I might think it's great from a team I worked with previously. It might be completely inappropriate for another team. All I would do is just try and facilitate that conversation. And you throw little bits in to kind of help it ease it along, but actually it's the team deciding those behaviours. They may suggest the behaviour I fundamentally disagree with. But it's not my role to say that. What I might do is allow them to put that in the working agreement and then just keep an eye. This is the thing about not knowing the end state. Just because I think that's a bad proposition, it may turn out to work really well for the team. That's me bringing my shit to the table.
What you're saying, Jeremy, is right in a way, because there is a structure. When the team says we agree to go agile, we're going to operate 2-week sprints in a scrum methodology. We're going to have the ceremonies on these regular days, the beginning and the end, and daily stand-ups. there is a commitment made by the team. But then I also hear what Dan's saying, that from there, it's very much allowing the team to make decisions and also to draw out the conversations where they reflect on the things that didn't go well.
Yes.
So at that retrospective, do you want to just talk briefly about the three or four things you might talk about at the end of a sprint?
Yeah, so it's really important. So you are looking for that element of continuous improvement, but it's really important you don't break what's made you good previously. So there's different ways, but they're basically around. So one is start, stop, more, less. So you might draw a flip chart into four sections, and you'll get people to write on post-its. What things do they want to start doing? What things do they want to stop doing? What behaviors or practices do they want more of? And what behaviors and practices do they want less of? And everyone does that from their one perspective. Those post-its go on the flip chart or the whiteboard, and then you kind of have a discussion around them. And what invariably tends to happen is those things kind of align around certain themes. So it may be let's say the theme is around kind of communication, and actually we want to start using our Slack channel more and emails less. So then you will take through that kind of that tangible outcome and say, okay, well let's try it. Let's see about our emails and see the ones that are actually just turned into long conversational threads. Those are the ones we should be having in Slack. And you're there to kind of just help them make those changes, help hold them accountable as well. Say, look, if 3 days after that retrospective, you then start seeing this email chain, it's perfectly okay for the coach to say, hey guys, I thought this was the sort of thing we were going to have on Slack. And what you get is everyone could say, oh yeah, cool. And they switch it over. So it's just like a little gentle reminder, because people will naturally fall back into their older patterns.
So Jeremy, can you sort of see from this that although it's quite easy for people to look at young people in hoodies and jeans and expensive sneakers, although they wouldn't even call them that, I'm showing my age, they would call them trainers. Sorry, trainers. Maybe even runners if they were really young. But to see them kicking around, vaping and swearing and having these meetings, and it seems a little bit almost fluffy, I think, to people outside of it at times, but it's actually very scientific. It takes a lot of energy. There's a lot of thought that goes into what are we going to do? Then what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? How is it going? How is it going? How did it go?
Yeah.
What are we going to do next? It's very meticulous in terms of a process. And it sounds like it comes from manufacturing.
Yeah.
Because it did.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we made the joke about like Scrum Masters and Agile Coaches. It's actually a lot of work to do this little, right? Because you don't have it. You're that servant leadership. I will lead you by doing what is best for you, not what is best for me.
And in many ways, it feels like the management top-down approach has been dispersed down into these types of roles.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that,
distributed.
That is when you get, and it's a way, again, these making better decisions. Like I use that analogy of the manager and the relay race. Well, yeah, like you can't argue with him, because what he is saying is correct if you're looking through his prism. Okay, he's looking, yeah, I'm utilizing all of these staff to the maximum amount of value, is not the right word, but they are extracting every penny from them,
sweating the asset.
Absolutely. But if you ask the teams, how would you run a relay race? They'd run it like that. They would run it in that way that got the baton to the end in the quickest amount of time. And I keep saying it, but that's why I have to do it, because, like I said, in my head I might know what this team should do, but that still might not be right. That's based off all my experience and the certifications and man and the books I read. But they may be more right. Okay. So then it's
because they are the experts.
And absolutely.
And generally, and the thing they're looking at. What about people who want to pick up an agile methodology and apply it to what they do?
Where would they start? Where would I start if I didn't know? So, honestly, so there are... Oh, shit.
The squeaky chair, folks.
Okay. YouTube is a great resource. I mean, you can put... The great thing with the agility and the agility space is there's some really great, engaging speakers who you can listen to and be able to understand it without even having any kind of prior knowledge. There's people like Alistair Coburn, Lisa Atkins, and they have a range of stuff. They have some really kind of nice bite-sized 5-minute talks where they introduce the concept to kind of the bigger an hour stuff. There's a lot of stuff on TEDx about agility. And then if after that you've got some more questions, you can always just ping me a message on LinkedIn, which is my profile, which is www.linkedin.com/IN/Daniel Milbank with 2 L's.
I will put that in the show notes also.
Thank you.
Great.
So have you enjoyed this chat?
I have indeed. Yeah. I've
Do you feel like you've learned something?
As a consequence of all of this. Because I've been looking at this thing and thinking, how on earth do you actually transition organisations into a space where people do actually like to go to work and actually feeling, you know, involved and part of it, as opposed to hating going to work? And suddenly you've got a mechanism, a framework, which is human-centred, seems to me. It's multidisciplinary, it's holistic in its approach and creative. And I think it's all the things that I would love to be a part of an organisation that does that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah, and it's a positive way of changing the way we work.
Yeah.
And also I like the fact that it's not just limited to manufacturing IT and software, but you can actually apply these principles in any sort of environment, any sort of company or organisation, large or small. And actually, the smaller the better, by the sound of it.
I mean, I've got a really good friend of mine who Kanban'd his kids' behaviour. So you mentioned it, things going from the left to the right. So in order to get some better behaviours around his kids, who are two lovely kids, by the way, but he would put the task, he would draw a Kanban board, which very simply has to do, in progress, done. That's it. That's all it is. And put all the good behaviours he wanted to instill. And then he put a value against them. Now, normally it would be points, but he put a monetary value, 20p, 50p, 80p, a pound. So taking the bit, emptying the bins. Okay. That's an 80p job. So, okay. So I'm going to take that. I'm going to put it in progress. I'm going to empty the bins, take them out. Boom. That's done. I've just made myself 80p. And actually now they can see how those things are moving across. That's like, okay, so he had to use a bit of money, and then you can talk about intrinsic and extrinsic motivators. You could argue that kids want to do better. They don't. They want some money to buy some stuff. Okay, so just leverage that. And he said it's amazing. And he's been a Kanban specialist for 15 years, and he did this thing 2 years ago.
I think that is the one thing about this podcast that's going to get the greatest reaction, I suspect.
Get a whiteboard.
My kids aren't getting more money out of me.
Get a whiteboard out, folks. To do, in progress, done.
Done.
Empty out the piggy bank. Thanks a lot for joining
very
us,
good.
Dan.
Great.
Oh, no, thank you very much. Thanks for having me, guys.
Enjoyed it.
Great fun.
Really interesting.
Really interesting conversation with Dan about the whole concept of agile thinking. And having had time to think about it, I'm more and more excited by it as a way of organisations managing difficult decisions and complex situations in a much more imaginative way. And it'd be just useful, we've brought Ben back, to get Ben to give us his insights, because he wasn't actually involved with the conversation, but having been on the outside of it, Ben, what was your feedback?
I found it quite interesting. Given the kind of work that I do and where I've kind of come from in terms of the kind of finance sector, technology is something that's coming into that sector, and it's already there and it's growing. And I think the contrast of seeing how the old guard view working practices and how this influence and sort of software developers, project managers and everything else come into the business is bringing a new wave of how we work. And I think Agile is the way forward.
Does your organisation use Agile?
I think, I don't know. I actually don't know, if I'm being very honest. But I've worked in organisations where you had Agile and you didn't. And you could see the difference in one, you know, productivity and actually overall happiness of how people worked and how they felt in their job. And
what do you mean by that?
I think just being somebody who actually felt they were valued in what they did. And I think sometimes the drone effect, which was what was discussed in the podcast, was very interesting. I'm not talking about my own personal experience. I can't talk for everyone else, but there were points where in industries and jobs that I've had where you just kind of feel like you're coming in. What if you went there, would anybody notice? I actually think that if you give people, you know, the idea of, oh, you're a product owner, that you are part of this team and we need you for this pivotal point, you come in and you have a more determined mindset when you come into work, I think. But generally, I just think that having a top-down structure doesn't always work. And I think the way forward seems to be this Agile movement. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next 10 years. But overall, I thought it was very, very interesting to hear what everyone had to say about it. And I think it was just a really, really, you know, good subject. Something I'm definitely going to read up on when I leave here. Maybe not today, but, you know.
I think it'd be great to have a session on design thinking as well, because I think they're related.
Mm.
And because it's interesting to see how Agile moves out of the sort of more technical areas and how it can be applied in other areas of the business.
Yeah, and I think for me, often I think about words and what they're being used to describe. And, you know, Agile, I think, could also be linked to the Matrix organization and the idea that people said, you know, join our business. We don't have top-down. We have a Matrix. Everybody's on the same level. You have teams. You have team leads, maybe. They work together to get things done. I think Agile's sort of grown out of that. Design thinking's related to that. The lean enterprise as the big picture of the company getting things done and the easiest, quickest way.
So how would that work then? So in terms of, say, for instance, once again, from the sector I'm in, you may have a partner or a director or someone who goes out, wins the business. They bring the business in, and then the team's job is to do the work. In my experience, you have to have a higher, and I'm not saying you have to, but there is a hierarchy. So the higher you, you know, the more important you get, or the, you know, further you go in your career, the more autonomy you have, but also the more expectation is you're going to win the business. Mm. But that comes with seniority.
Mm.
Now, obviously, there are some organizations where it doesn't matter how junior or senior you are, you can go out and win business. But I just feel that, how would that change in an Agile environment? Is that an Agile environment where everyone would be all the same level, but you all have defined different roles? Does that work?
Sure. So I think the critical thing is that Agile is a way of delivering work.
Yeah.
So it's a way for, so the partner still brings the work in,
mm-hmm.
and says to the team, I've got this bit of work that needs to be done. It's going to take this amount of time. The team says, whoa, hang on a sec. Let's actually look at this work.
Yeah.
What are we talking about here? They ask a whole lot of questions. They chunk it up into spaces and or into phases. And they say, right, for this first phase and the next 2 weeks, we think we can get this done. Now, I know in your industry, there's a lot of long nights and a lot of people working really long hours to get something done really quickly.
Yeah.
Perhaps it didn't need to be that way. Perhaps if the team had actually estimated how long that work was going to take, and if that had been the team's decision based on when it will be delivered,
that
would have been more the Agile mindset. And for the people, you would hope that that's more healthy.
In a high-pressure environment where everything's really quick, where we need this done within a week, we need this done in a month's time, we need this done now, today. Does that work, that type of environment? Does that work? You know, because surely capacity of your staff as well as the expertise of your staff and also the amount of staff you have, do you have time to do that, sit down and really think about it?
Well, I think that what's interesting about Agile and how it's applied to high tech is that everything changes all the time. And it's literally understood. So if I think about my last week at work, there were U-turns on things that we'd defined several days before. Like that level of change and then new deadlines being set during the week for that week is you know, we live in that world, and it takes its toll on people in some ways, and so there's got to be a bit of give or take in the culture as well, and people work from home or have days off when they get burned out after a really high period of work. But in that kind of situation where something has to be done now, then it's not so much that the team says no, it's that the team says how. And agile is how they talk about what could be delivered in that time. They know they have to do it. But the question is, how are we going to divide up the work? How are we going to get it done as quickly as possible?
See, for me, the interesting thing for me was the whole cultural piece. And because I think those are the elements that are transferable to any business and any part of the business.
Yeah, I agree.
And the notion of a servant leader, I think, is a brilliant one. This idea that says the boss, the old-fashioned boss, his job is to create the environment that allows people, enables people to be really, really effective. I mean, his job seems to be to clear away all the potential obstacles to allow people to be more effective. Now, you can apply that thinking anywhere, and that's not traditional thinking. And the second thing is about devolving responsibility further down the organization. So individuals take on much more personal responsibility for delivering stuff, and they're given the autonomy to do it, and they're treated as adults. And I think that is a huge cultural shift, because every organization I've ever worked for, actually the people that know what's happening are the people who are doing it. Yeah. And what agile seems to do, or the agile thinking seems to do, is recognize that and simply say, look, these guys know on a day-to-day basis how to get something done. Okay, they might need a bit of direction, and then they might need a framework. My job as their manager or whatever, a manager becomes an obsolete sort of term, is to create the environment which allows them to operate more effectively. And if you look at things like the National Health Service, where you've got some really, really competent people working at the ground level, the thing that prevents them being really effective is this huge bureaucracy above them, constantly changing the ballpark, you know, changing the rules and changing the objectives and so on and so forth.
And that's just the same internationally.
Absolutely.
In healthcare.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's where it's the cultural thing that seems to me totally appropriate to the way things are evolving, and agile is at the centre of that.
I think culturally what you're talking about is very interesting, because working environments, you know, where I am at the moment, working on a project that's, you know, quite demanding, but doesn't matter what seniority you are, people are giving you the autonomy to go off and do the work, you have a much bigger sense of satisfaction, and actually you become a subject matter expert, or you begin to realise that you have more to deliver. You're treated as an adult, essentially, and you have more to give because of the fact that you've been given that ability to say, well, you go and figure it out for yourself. And you,
do you feel that you have more ownership of the outcome?
I actually do, at least in this in the instance that I'm thinking about, I actually feel like I do, whereas the other places I've worked in other industries, I actually feel that if you don't treat your staff with, how can I put it, you don't feel that your staff can handle what they're doing, or you don't give them the ability to go off and find out, have autonomy, then either A, you're not hiring the right people because you don't have the confidence, or B, you really need to think about the way that you manage your organization. Because actually, when you give people a chance and you're confident that that person can do it, sometimes people can't, but if you're confident, then actually, you know, they usually deliver and they do a really good job and they learn something and they add value moving forward as well.
It's about talent management as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a shortage of talent.
Yes.
People will go to places where they like to work and where they're appreciated and valued. If they're not, you lose them.
And I wonder if that's why tech is where you're seeing agile really blossom.
Yeah.
Because there's such a shortage, things change so quickly and there's always a shortage.
But also it's interesting because the people that are going to be the servant leaders, it's going to require refined area, you know, expertise in areas of like sort of emotional intelligence.
Sure.
Which has never been considered a premium requirement, but actually is becoming more and more important.
Mm.
And so I think that's in itself is going to change the way things work.
And the way leadership is developed.
I'm nodding vigorously here because I'm just thinking, you know, emotional intelligence is such an important skill for a leader to have. And I love the term servant leader. It's just a fantastic term because at the end of the day, it's not about talks. It's I'm here to make sure that you are given the best tools to do what you can do. And that's what a leader is. You know, this whole kind of patriarchal kind of society where you look up and they give you, yeah, exactly, Ollie's not wagging his finger. It's essentially that, you know, you do this and it's my way or the highway, just doesn't work because we're more informed now. But also giving people more responsibility.
It works.
It does. It really does, you know.
I have to say the language, I love the language. You know, not just servant leader, but things like Scrum. Mm. And things like, what was the expression for these meeting ceremonies?
Yeah.
So you don't have a meeting, you have a ceremony.
Yeah.
And it's the power of language. And it puts a completely different, you know, you go into a ceremony, you have a completely different expectation about what your role in that is and what the purpose of it is.
And the morning meeting is not a morning meeting, it's a morning stand-up.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that there is some scepticism to using those words?
I'm sure there is.
Yeah. There's scepticism about everything.
Yeah, no, yeah, true. Very good point.
I mean, a lot of people will be switched off by that.
Yeah,
you have exactly. You have to be in a certain frame of mind, you know.
But that comes down to hiring the right people sometimes, though. I think, or having the right people in your organisation.
But it's also about leading people in a direction.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
And as people start to realise the benefit of it, and when they feel part of it, I think you get buy-in.
Absolutely. I mean, let's take another example. If you think about the first time you heard someone say one-on-one in an organization, I can remember the first few times and people sort of laughing about it and being like, oh, one-on-one, got to have a little chat, a little one-on-one. But now a one-to-one is just something that you do with your team.
One-on-one for me is essentially when you used to play football in Scotland and it was a bad time. You know, you play against somebody that's a lot better than you and they just take the piss out of you, essentially.
But it's one-to-one.
Yeah, one-to-one, fair enough. Yeah. But I do like the idea of a one-to-one. It is a personal, you know.
But as a phrase, exactly. When it first came along, it was resisted. At least it was in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, that's
and it was considered a bit airy-fairy. But now that's just the way you catch up. And it's known that that's a weekly catch-up with a team lead. That's not a serious thing. It's not a disciplinary type autocratic meeting. It's a what do you need from me? How are things going? What do we need to talk about?
But also it's a signal of change. The moment you change the language,
yeah.
In cultural terms, when you're trying to shift a culture from A to B, to have a signal that says, look, suddenly we're starting to change the language around what a meeting is and what a this is and what a that is, it encourages people to move into a different space. You have a different expectation. And the moment you set that up, you start to get different behaviours. It gives people permission to a degree, to behave in a slightly different way, to question the way things were done before. I think that was all great.
Very good. And Speaking of changing behaviours and the way that people look at things, that's going to take us on to our next episode, isn't it, Jeremy? So thanks for tuning in, folks. The next episode will be about staying healthy at work.
Very good.
Brilliant.
Thanks, Ben.
I think Jeremy might have felt that he had a little bit more to say.
Right.
Are you?
Don't censor me.
Exactly. Personally, I think this subject will be over very fast.
Do you? No. Thanks for the vote of confidence.
I can't think of the words. So I have to stop. Sequential. Sorry, I'll start again.
Okay. Do you want to go?
I'm not. You guys are putting an insane amount of pressure on, but anyway, let's go for it.